welcome to another edition of the LinuxQuestions.org podcast. First up, LQ updates. First up, LQ update I have for you is the addition of FOF support to your LQ profile. And what FOF is friend of a friend. We all know that one of the main benefits of open source is the ability to avoid vendor lock-in, and I've mentioned that both on the podcast and blog many times in the past. One thing that often gets overlooked, though, is data lock-in. And as these so-called web services get more and more popular, and they really, really are, the importance of data lock-in will become more and more clear. Now, one project that aims to help in this regard is FOF, which, as I mentioned, is friend of a friend. Now, it's based on RDF, and basically, FOF allows you to express personal information and relationships about that information in a standardized way. I am happy to report that as of just under a week ago, you can now get FOF information for any LQ member via their profile page and for yourself via your user control panel. Now, we're still polishing this up a bit, and there's quite a bit to the FOF specification as far as what you can export. We've kind of started with the basics, and as I go through it, as I think things are applicable, I will add them. But everything is working as expected now, and it validates and all that stuff. So this is probably something in reality that we should have supported a long time ago, but I guess better late than never, as they say. The next LQ story I have for you is that we've added a little bit of social networking to LQ. With the number of registered members that we have, which is well over 200,000 now, I thought it made a lot of sense to add a little bit of social networking to the site. Now, some of the bare basics have really always been there, but the data was either hidden or extremely hard to get at. So, for example, you could always add someone to your buddy list, which is really a form of social networking, but you couldn't easily view your network or someone else's network, see who was a buddy to who, and things like that. As of a couple of days ago, that all changed. The feature kind of still can be considered in beta, but it is 100% working at this point. It's really still in a concept phase, though, and there's a lot more that I want to do with it. As of now, you can view the social network of LQ really from any arbitrary starting point. If you go to any member profile page, there's going to be a link there to view their social network. So anyone they link to and anyone that links to them, you'll be able to see. Now, to view your own social network, you can either go to your user member page or go to your user control panel, and on the left-hand side there, you'll see view your social network. This really is just the start of the networking features that I would like to add. I can really envision somewhere along in the near future being able to, for instance, find members who have similar interests, members who run similar or identical distributions, things like that. As always, we're really looking for feedback on this feature. There's a lot of different directions I think that it could go, but I want to hear where you think it should go. Like I've mentioned many times, the recent redesign was really just the beginning. We have some really cool stuff on the horizon, and this is just an example of how much more of an extensible platform we really have now. Speaking of the redesign, I mentioned that I'd highlight a couple new features and changes of that redesign in every podcast. Today I'm just going to highlight two quick changes. They're not really additional features, but more just kind of added functionality. Now, if you're in any forum and you hover over a thread title for about a second, you'll get a preview of the first post. And this is a quick and easy way to see if you actually want to click on that thread and kind of view the whole thing. Second, if you click on any username in a post over on the left-hand side there, what you'll get is a drop-down with a bunch of information about that user. You'll be able to access their profile page, see their contributions to the LQ Wiki, see their social bookmarks at bookmarks.linuxquestions.org, and get a variety of more information. The last LQ story I have for you. There seems to have been a lot more interest than I had anticipated, asking for our experience with the upgraded LQ infrastructure, and that was moving to Apache 2.2.x and PHP 5.1.x, and we were running considerably older versions before. It's not like we upgraded from Apache 2.0 and PHP 5.0. We upgraded from Apache 1.3 and PHP 4.4. Now, Apache 2.2.0 has been absolutely rock solid in every way for us. It's also been anecdotally slightly faster than 1.3. Nothing too substantial, though, so I wouldn't say that performance alone is a reason to upgrade, but the changes in features based on, if you look at the change log from the older version to 2.2.0, it's really a myriad features have been added. So based on my experience with LQ, I would definitely suggest the 2.2 branch of Apache to anyone that asks. It's been fantastic. On to PHP. PHP 5.1.2 is what we're running now, has also been extremely solid. And some of the new features of PHP 5 when compared to 4.4 really are handy when you're coding things. It makes a lot of things easier, or if not easier, cleaner, which from a maintainability perspective is absolutely essential. So if you're not tied to PHP 4 for backwards compatibility reasons, and there are a couple fairly significant changes, so you are going to want to look at your code, I'd say go for the PHP upgrade also. Now, one huge, huge caveat that I have to give there is that if you're running APC, which is the alternative PHP cache, with PHP 5, it has been extremely unstable for us. Now, I'm not sure if it's PHP 5 and APC, or just that we're running a different PHP code base with APC, but we've seen fairly consistent and extremely reproducible APC-related seg faults. Now, the good news here is that there are many, many bug reports in the Peckle bug tracker about this, so it is a known issue, and hopefully it'll be addressed soon. I know Rasmus had made a couple comments in those bugs, so the appropriate people definitely do know about it. Now, in the meantime, if you need to use APC for performance reasons, and LQ definitely does fall into that category, you're going to want some kind of watchdog on Apache to make sure that if you do get those seg faults, you take care of them so everything runs smoothly. Now, onto the news. The first story I have is in regards to the Linux kernel and GPL version 3. And this is a follow-up to something that I actually covered in last week's podcast. It looks like Linus has responded to the question of whether the Linux kernel will be released under the updated version of the GPL. And here's the answer, and this was posted to the Linux kernel mailing list. And I'm actually going to give two quotes. The post was a little bit longer, but I selected two. The first one is, quote, "The Linux kernel is under the GPL version 2, not anything else. Some individual files are licensable under version 3, but not the kernel in general. And quite frankly, I don't see that changing," end quote. And the next quote is, quote, "You think V2 or later is the default. It's not. The default is to not allow conversion. Conversion isn't going to happen," end quote. So that seems like a fairly definitive answer to me. I really, though, find two things fascinating about this Linux kernel mailing list thread. The first thing that I noticed scrolling through some of the replies is that Alan Cox definitely doesn't seem to agree with Linus on that. In fact, here's a quote from Alan. Quote, "Very few people specifically put their code V2 only, and the Linus edit of the top copying file was not done with permission of other copyright holders anyway, so really only affects his code if it's valid at all. What finally happens is going to depend almost entirely on whether the GPL version 3 is a sane license or not, and on consensus, and it's way too early to figure that out," end quote. And the other thing that I found interesting is that if you scroll back all the way to see who the thread starter itself was on this topic, it was Jeff V. Murky. Now, you might remember Jeff as the person who, quite some time ago, offered $50,000 for a BSD copy of the Linux kernel, and he was also then traced back to the Canopy group, which you know is closely tied with SCO. So you definitely have to wonder what he's up to by starting that thread, and he has participated on LKML with some amount of consistency and to some amount of flame fests since his original offer. So where he's going with that, I'm not quite sure. Another thing you have to wonder, though, is how close is the final version of GPL v3 going to be to the recently released draft? Now, some of the new clauses do seem a bit restrictive, especially if you're coming at this not from the OSS side like a lot of us are, but from the business side. It almost seems a little too political, really. Now, while I dislike DRM as much as the next person, and not in all actuality, I probably dislike DRM much, much more than the average person, I'm not yet convinced that a free software license is really the place for this type of battle. And it just comes down to that it's quite a slippery slope, because where's the line? Will other items that the Free Software Foundation doesn't like creep into the next version? And if it does, what happens when something that the Free Software Foundation doesn't like isn't something that people hate as much as DRM? So making that precedent, I just don't think is a good thing to do. Now, like I said, we'll have to wait and see what the final version looks like. And I think what the final version looks like, obviously, is going to have a huge, huge impact on its adoption. We could be getting kind of a headache here. If version 3 has some clauses that prevent a large amount of uptake immediately, what we're going to get into a situation is, because version 3 has additional restrictions when compared with version 2, it's not compatible. So we could have a situation where a bunch of projects stick with version 2, a bunch of projects go with version 3, and then code for those projects can't flow back and forth, because even though they're both under the GPL, they're under incompatible versions of the GPL. And that would be, I think, categorically bad. So we'll have to see what the final version looks like to see how this plays out, but it's something we should definitely keep our eye on. The next story I have is Microsoft to open Windows to please EU. And this was a recent article that was in Forbes about how Microsoft intends to allow the source code to Windows to be viewed. The details are a little fuzzy. It looks like you'd have to pay some amount of money, and there wasn't a lot of details as far as what the procedure would be or how much money would be involved. And while on the outside it sounds fantastic, this is absolutely not what the European Union wanted in the case, and when it comes down to it, surprisingly, is mostly useless. Now, I'm going to read a snippet here from the original EU press release after the case. As regards interoperability, Microsoft is required within 120 days to disclose complete and accurate interface documentation, which would allow non-Microsoft workgroup servers to achieve full interoperability with Windows PCs and servers. This will enable rival vendors to develop products that can compete on a level playing field in the workgroup server operating system market. The disclosed information will have to be updated each time Microsoft brings to the market new versions of its relevant products. Continuing on with the press release, to the extent that any of this interface information might be protected by intellectual property in the European Economic Area, Microsoft would be entitled to reasonable remuneration. The disclosure order concerns the interface documentation only and not the Windows source code, as this is not necessary to achieve the development of interoperable products. And that's the end. So that's right, they have specifically detailed in there that they do not need source code. So what they want and what they clearly outline is that the accurate interface documentation. So you might be wondering why they specifically said they didn't need source code and why they make clearly outlined that accurate interface documentation is what they're after. In the context we're talking here, the source code is of no use for multiple reasons, and one of them being patents. So if one of the Samba developers, who I had a lengthy talk with Jeremy at the Linux World UK about how Samba really is developed now, and it's a matter of literally looking at the wire, performing an action, seeing how the Windows server reacts. So it's very time-consuming, very tedious. You need a high level of knowledge. And if one of those developers were to look at the source code and then, say, add a related feature or fix to Samba, both the code and the developer would at that point really be legally tainted. So in the end, what's that mean? Well, obviously that they wouldn't look at the code. What would help, and what was asked for, like I said, was something that would be both useful and not legally encumbering, and that's full and accurate interface documentation. No more undocumented APIs, no more hidden hooks, and the elimination of any other measures that don't allow for fair competition. What Microsoft has done here, really, and brilliantly so, I have to say, from a PR and marketing standpoint, is appear to the average person to be offering more than what was asked for, while in reality offering much, much less. Now, there's still more details to come on this, so who knows how it's going to end up. You know, one of the stipulations based on this might be that the only code delivery methods available to you are either Braille or microfiche or something. So I've seen no official response from the EU on this yet, and I did notice a court date in the Forbes article of April 24th to 28th. So I hope that the EU does not allow this move to stand to satisfy the remedy section of the case as stands originally. And I am looking for a response. If I just missed it and anyone has seen it, do point that out to me, as I am interested how the EU will respond to this. On the Microsoft note, the last story I have for you is Slashdot's Ask Microsoft Security VP. And this was an extremely interesting read over on Slashdot. Basically, they sent the highest moderated questions and comments from the original article to Microsoft Security VP Mike Nash, who then agreed to answer those with no PR scrubbing or PR involved at all, is my understanding. Now, this is a really long read, and there's just a ton of information in the response. And as you may have guessed, some of it's kind of good, and some of it's either rubbish or not so good news. One thing I think that's clear here is that the original Microsoft security push 2002 was when they said their new focus was security and they were going to do all these different kind of things, was nothing but lip service. And he makes a reference to the difference between now and then is then if he tried to do something that was not good for business but was good for security, he didn't have the support of the higher-ups who were the main ones giving this lip service, where now it seems that he actually does. So that's good that that's changed. Another thing I think that became clear was that while security definitely has a higher priority now, and it's clear that he does have the support of some of the higher-ups, there are still some groups or at least people within Microsoft that are ignoring this, and they just don't get it, I think, is a lot of the problem. There was a comment/question from an anonymous Microsoft employee that made it as one of the 10 questions that were asked, and it really pointed out a very specific example of where the security kind of was slipping through the cracks and why he thought it was failing. It's kind of interesting to see Mike's response to that, which was to contact him privately and also anonymously so that he could further look into things. The article also reminded me just how mammoth Microsoft really is. The sheer number of initiatives and acronyms and procedures and policies in place are just astronomical. And given that, it's really not hard to understand why it's taken them this long to turn the security train around. Old habits die really hard, and it's you know obvious that business pressures are still a very high priority at Microsoft. So given the option of not getting a product shipped on time or missing a feature that was promised to a vendor or a partner, or shipping it on time or with that feature with a security flaw, some Microsoft teams are still clearly choosing the latter, although I'm glad to see the push is to the former. It was fantastic to see, though, in the end, that someone like Mike, who is very high up at Microsoft, is willing to speak kind of directly to the users like this, with no PR involved and no press person going over it and editing things out, just him answering directly to the community. And that's something that's fantastic, and kudos to him. And you got to give kudos to Microsoft for allowing that. So I do recommend you read the full article. It's actually dated today, so if you just go to Slashdot, it should still be on the homepage by the time you listen to this. That's all I have for now. Thanks for listening. And remember, if you like the LQ podcast, please head over to podcastalley.com and vote for us.